Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
At Locomotion Shildon this April and May, early railway historian Dr. Michael Bailey and colleagues will be delving into the history of a mysterious, unnamed engine. Thought to be the world's first replica locomotive dating from 1855, the mystery engine has been referred to as the Hetton engine after the colliery in County Durham where it spent its operational life. This exciting research project aims to reveal further secrets about the world's very oldest steam engines. Locomotion Shildon is part of the Science Museum Group and is home to more than 70 rail vehicles from the National Collection. For more information about this project, our museum and our exciting programme of events, visit locomotion.org.uk.
We're very privileged today to have with us Dr. Michael Bailey, who is an expert in early locomotives, and he's going to tell us a little bit more about Rocket. Hello, Dr. Bailey.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning. Could you tell us a bit more about George Stephenson and what his background was, please?
George Stephenson was born and brought up in the Northumberland coalfield. His father worked in the coalfield, and it was only natural that his son George would join him there. He very quickly became very proficient in steam engines, and when he made substantial savings to his employer with one of the steam engines that was getting difficult, then of course he came to notice, and therefore he was given more responsibility at the Westmoor Colliery in Killingworth. Then when the opportunity came, it was noted that at the Wylam Colliery, just to the west of Killingworth, it was noted that they were using steam locomotives, trial steam locomotives, Puffing Billy and Wylam Dilly. George Stephenson was asked by the proprietors, can we at Killingworth use a steam locomotive? And George Stephenson said, yes, let me build a trial steam locomotive, which he did. And it was first came onto the rails in the summer of 1814. It was named Blücher, after the Field Marshal Blücher of the Prussian Army, to do with the battles against Napoleon, of course. It was named that because although it was Stephenson's first attempt, it worked hard and it did not give up, which is the symbol, if you like, of the Field Marshal. It worked, not terribly well, but it did the job, and it demonstrated to the proprietors of the colliery that it would be worth making some other more powerful steam locomotives to haul the coals from the Westmoor Colliery all the way down to the Tyne for shipment to London and elsewhere. So soon after that, the following year, a patent was taken out by George Stephenson and William Dodds, the viewer, the engineer of Killingworth Colliery, for improvements to the steam locomotive, and the loco was built shortly afterwards, the first of the principal locos on the Killingworth line. And thereafter, further improvements were made, including a locomotive built in 1816 that survives. It survives up in the Stephenson Railway Museum on North Tyne side, near to the old Killingworth wagonway, and that was Killingworth Billy, much rebuilt, but it survives in that museum. And from then on, of course, George Stephenson carried out further improvements to the locos on the Killingworth line, each one getting slightly larger, until in 1821 he made quite a large locomotive that demonstrated only too well how good steam locos were at the job of moving coal down to the tying.
And this obviously led to Stevenson designing Rocket for the trials of the Rainhill and the Liverpool-Manchester Railway.
Well, yes, we've got a few stages to go through, of course. The Hetton Railway, the Stockton and Darlington Railway, and so on. But George Stevenson, his career accelerated when, first of all, he was asked to build the Hetton Railway, then the Stockton and Darlington, and subsequently the Liverpool and Manchester. But when the Liverpool and Manchester was being built, he was the engineer in charge, and so he was his time was fully taken up supervising the various works on the, along the line. So who was to improve the locomotive from the slow 5 miles an hour coal hauling locomotives that he had in the northeast? Who was to improve the locomotive to become a mainline locomotive, or the first of a fleet of mainline locomotives that could run for over 30 miles between Manchester and Liverpool and back? He fell back on his son, Robert Stevenson. Now, Robert Stevenson, by this time, we're talking now about 1828, when he returned from his trip to South America. He came back, and George Stevenson gave him the task, first of all, of taking over other railways that George Stevenson was responsible for, the Canterbury and Whitstable and the Leicester and Swannington and others. And it was also left to Robert Stevenson to develop the steam locomotive beyond what George Stevenson had already developed. Robert's approach was quite different from that of his father, because his father approached steam locomotives empirically. If it worked, do it again, but make it bigger. What Robert Stevenson realised was that you needed to examine each of the components of the steam locomotive and see where improvements could be made, principally to make more steam. And as a result of all the work that he carried out, and a suggestion, incidentally, by the secretary of the Liverpool and Manchester Railway, Henry Booth, why don't you have a series of multiple tubes in the boiler surrounded by the water, creating a lot more steam than just one flue tube, which had hitherto been the case. And so that was the major change that ensured that Rocket performed so well at the Rainhill trials. Other ones, of course, the cylinders and the wheels and so on, but he managed to make a locomotive that was light in frame. It fulfilled the requirements of the Rainhill trials, and at the same time it didn't run out of steam, as simple as that. And so it performed extremely well, much, much better than the other competitors at the trials.
What sets Rocket apart to its predecessors?
Rocket was a giant step forward with regard to steam generation. The introduction of a multi-tubular boiler created so much more steam than the old single flue boilers of the Killingworth engines and others that followed on the Stockton and Darlington. It generated so much more steam, it meant that it was possible for the locomotive to steam all the way between Manchester and Liverpool with reliability. You can't obviously introduce a service unless you've got reliable motive power, and that's what Rocket provided. Also, it was much lighter than the old colliery engines working at Killingworth and on the Stockton and Darlington. And consequently, by keeping the weight down, it meant that the locomotive could perform over the lightweight track of the Liverpool and Manchester Railway quite satisfactorily. But the previous locomotives to this that were made by the Stevenson Company, they actually were part of what today we would call a research and development program. We can't take Rocket in isolation. When Robert Stevenson began his work at the beginning of 1828, then he introduced a series of improvements on a number of prototype locomotives which were made available to customers of the Robert Stevenson factory in Newcastle. And each one introduced improvements. All of these improvements were incorporated in Rocket. But of course, the development work did not stop there. It was a bit like your mobile phone. When you get your mobile phone, you just bought it at the shop, you get it home, it's out of date straight away. Such was the rate of improvements. Rocket was old technology by the time the railway was open in September of 1830. And so what we see now is in fact not Rocket as it was in 1829, but Rocket as it was rebuilt over several occasions through its short working career. And so it would be possible to point out some of those improvements that were made after the Rainhill trials.
One of the things that always fascinates me about George Stephenson and Robert Stephenson is that, today when engineering pieces are designed, there's a lot of computer technology goes into it. How did they do the calculations, and how did they work out whether a piece of metal was going to be sufficient enough to take the pressure that it was going to be under, for example?
Yes,
or was it trial and error?
Well, it was an element of trial and error. But the craftsman who made Rocket, as indeed all the other locomotives up in Newcastle, they knew what they were doing. They started their careers in the time of the millwrights. In other words, the millwrights did all the calculations. The tradesmen, each tradesman made the component that they knew best. The wheelwrights made the wheels. The boilersmiths made the boilers, and so on. The fitters made the other components. But as time progressed, of course, that wasn't sufficient, because improvements meant you needed to have larger locomotives, more powerful locomotives, and yet you had to arrange them in such a way that they fitted between four wheels, or very soon afterwards, six wheels. What Robert Stephenson did was to introduce a draftsman. Now, nothing new in draftsmen, but draftsmen responsible for sorting out the arrangement of the locomotives to incorporate all of these improvements that they were incorporating. And that draftsman, George Phipps was his name, played an important part in the layout, not only of Rocket, but all of the subsequent locomotives. That program continued until the opening of the Liverpool and Manchester Railway, and beyond, of course. But it's an extraordinary point to reflect on, is that Robert Stephenson was given the task by his father to create a locomotive that would provide reliable motive power for the Liverpool and Manchester Railway when it opened. Robert Stephenson took the locomotive as we see it, it was seen on the colliery lines and on the Stockton and Darlington, a slow, lumbering locomotive, to Rocket and onto Planet. That's when the real program finished, onto Planet, and it all took just 33 months. And that was an extraordinary progression it has to be one of the fastest improvements in mechanical engineering the world's ever seen.
That's just absolutely amazing. When you look at how long it takes to introduce and design and build a new train today, that is actually quite a remarkable achievement.
It's absolutely.
In those days.
Yes, indeed.
Michael, tell me about Rocket's career and what you discovered during the archaeological exploration of the locomotive.
The project that we undertook 20 years ago now was part archival and part archaeological. It's only by combining those two programs together could we understand what it was we were actually looking at. Rocket was accident prone. We know about its accident to Paul William Huskisson on the opening day of the Liverpool and Manchester line, where Huskisson, of course, was run over and sadly killed. But only 6 weeks later, after the opening of the line, Rocket had another accident. And on this occasion, it was propelling a train of ballast wagons along the line from Shatmoss back here to Manchester. And suddenly an axle broke on the tender. Tender collapsed in a heap, the engine was derailed and damaged. But even more sadly is that there was a young lad on board who just thumbed a lift. He was obviously an early railway enthusiast. Thumbed a lift, he was catapulted from the tender, he was run over and he was killed. That was just within 6 weeks of the opening. There were other accidents as well. A nasty one in Olive Mount Cutting in 1831. Now, when these accidents happened, the railway took the locomotive back to Liverpool, to Edge Hill, where they had a small workshop, to make repairs. In fact, they had to call in contractors to undertake some of these repairs. But such had been the speed of the developments in locomotive technology, as demonstrated on the later locos, that they decided to retrofit Rocket with some of these improvements. And these we can see on the locomotive today. One of the principal ones was that Rocket initially primed very badly. That is because the water level was kept as high as possible, because the firebox, which was a separate box from the boiler, firebox was in risk of exposure and obviously obvious damage and therefore they kept the water high, which meant it primed badly. So they took the opportunity of putting on one of the improvements that we first saw on Invicta on the Canterbury and Whitstable, and that is it has a steam riser inside a dome above the boiler. And they said, right, if we were to do that, have a steam riser, then it would be possible to raise the water level and reduce the risk to the top of the firebox. And that's what they took advantage of after that first accident. So they put a dome on, and they put in a steam feed pipe thereafter, which was much drier and reduced the incidence of priming. And the evidence is there. Every hole that you can see on the side of the boiler or on the side of the frame, that there's a hole, has a reason for being there. And that's what we had to do in our archaeological survey, was to identify what each hole represented and when it was put on. Another example too is that rocket was needed to buffer up to vehicles at its front end, not just its tender end. And so they took advantage of putting on a buffer beam. But this was put on after the Olive Mound accident. Now, the Olive Mount accident, it was serious because one of the wheels failed and the locomotive was badly damaged, but it was taken back, new wheels were made, so we know that these wheels date from 1831, and also evidence is here. If I could just point it out to you, you can see the main longitudinal frame member has a crack in it, and that is because initially it was, in that accident, it was bent underneath. They coaled... straightened it, and in so doing it cracked, and so they put on a supplementary frame. You can see the bar on above the main frame bar and also a diagonal cross member to give it much more strength when they put the buffer beam on. Since then it's had further accidents and heavy shunts, and one of the heavy shunts, you can see the effect now, you can see that front beam is bent. That's even the strengthening beam is bent, so it's been a subsequent collision, and the buffer beam itself is correspondingly bent. So there's lots and lots of clues like that which pan out with all of the archival work that we did to understand when these accidents happened, why they happened, and what they did. And of course it wasn't just on the Liverpool and Manchester line. It was also when Rocket was sold second hand to the Naworth Collieries up in Cumbria, or Cumberland, owned by the Earl of Carlisle. There it moved an awful lot of coal during its short career there, from 1836 to 1840. And when it did so, it had under buffers, because the vehicles used on the Naworth Colliery were lower dumb buffers. And so they were fitted. There is evidence still there of these dumb buffers and the way they were fitted on that diagonal frame there. So every little hole tells a story, and that's what we teased out during the course of the project.
What other developments were undertaken with the locomotive before it was finally withdrawn from service?
Well, the interesting one is that it was actually withdrawn from service quite early on, because there's a limit to how much you can retrofit improvements. And by the time you got to 1833, you were into patentee locomotives, which were so much stronger and faster than Rocket. They withdrew it from service. They then used it as a test bed. Lord Dundonald, who was something of an inventor, invented a rotary steam engine. By rotary, he had the engine surrounding the axle and introduced steam to drive propellers around the housing of there to create the rotary motion, and thus he thought have a much more efficient form of motive power than the reciprocating motion that we're used to seeing on Rocket. That wasn't successful. But nevertheless, it meant that Rocket was still there, still available for use. Lord Dundonald was thanked them very profusely, but it wasn't pursued. But after that, 1836, then Rocket was sold second-hand to the Earl of Carlisle, and it went up to finish its days on the Naworth Colliery line.
So in reality, it had a very short career then?
Very short career indeed. It was taken out of service finally in 1840. So it had a maximum life of just 11 years.
Could you actually explain some of the work you undertook during the archaeological exploration, please?
Yes, by all means. This was the fourth archaeological work that we have done on the locomotive, we being my colleague John Glitherow and myself. This was a request by the National Railway Museum when Rocket was up in York in 1999 during rebuilding work in South Kensington. And so it gave us a golden opportunity to examine the locomotive in more detail than had been possible on previous occasions. But coupled with that, it was important to undertake an awful lot of archival work to try and tease out the story of Rocket as written down anywhere in notes, in diaries, in newspaper reports and so forth. So those two aspects of the study were taken together. And so as we went over the locomotive during the course of 1999, we came to understand exactly what had happened to Rocket, component by component, and the order in which those changes had been made as a result of all the many accidents that it had had and the changes that had been correspondingly made. We began to build up this picture of Rocket and its life during its working life, and could answer some of the obvious questions. I mean, for example, it was written down in a letter by Robert Stevenson that when the firebox, which was made in Liverpool by the men who actually copper-bottomed shipping vessels, when they made it, they hadn't got the locomotive with them. They just made a box, shipped it to Newcastle. And when the men received the box and put it onto the frame, it wasn't quite square. It was actually out a bit. And so we've always known that because that letter has been in history books and so on over the years, not quite square built. But only when John and I were able to examine the frame, we could see the pattern of holes of how the firebox had sat when it was first made. Sadly, the firebox itself is gone now. All of the non-ferrous components were withdrawn following its withdrawal from service in 1840, so we're only left with the skeletal remains. But those clues of the holes and where the firebox sat is just one example of the detail that you can tease out of the physical examination during a project such as ours.
So it's almost forensic in its...
Yes, it is. It's a forensic archaeological study.
Yeah, yeah.
And since then, we've gone on to do two more studies, just concluding just recently with Killingworth Billy up in on Tyneside. And there's one or two others in the pipeline.
Michael, this is a replica of Novelty, which I understand contains parts of the original locomotive. Could you enlighten us a bit more about the Novelty?
Yes, indeed. This replica was made by the Science Museum back in 1929 because they had inherited some of the original components of the original Novelty locomotive, and they thought it would be better portrayed on by creating this replica. And so certainly one of the cylinders and some of the other gear, including the wheels incidentally, they have survived and they have been put on. So what we're looking at is the original wheels and one at least of the original cylinders. I should say that the other cylinder also survives over in Rainhill Library, which provides further opportunity to see the locomotive. But obviously the boiler is completely a replica representation rather than any original component.
I mean, compared to looking at Rocket, the cylinders on this locomotive look quite small.
Yeah, the whole thing looks so very different from Rocket. Actually, it was the favourite of the huge crowds that turned out. It's because it was rather more familiar in shape. It's very similar to fire engines that Braithwaite used to make. They were horse-drawn, but the fire was there, so the boiler was there to create steam for the hoses to put out fires.
Yes, you can see that familiarity.
Exactly.
Yes,
so yes. Because it was so familiar, everyone said that must be the one that we want to win. In practice, it's so very different from rocket that it could not keep up the volume of steam that was required for the full distance between Manchester and Liverpool. It worked on its own. It performed extremely well at Rainhill without being under load. But under load and for long distance, it just wasn't man enough for the job.
And the coal would have been in these baskets.
That's right. Yeah. Yes, the coal was simply loaded on in baskets onto the main frame there. The fireman stood right alongside the boiler, obviously. There was a little hatch at the top. You fed the coke into the top there, shut that, and then the coke would fall down into the fire. There is a major hazard with coke, which we found out when we undertook a televised re-enaction of the Rainhill trials back in 2003. It was broadcast, part of the BBC's Horizon programme. And what we found is that the firemen on the replica, the other replica locomotive, which is now back in Sweden, the firemen suffered from carbon monoxide poisoning. Because as you put the coke in, some of the carbon monoxide would escape, and he started to feel unwell. And that's a hazard that sort of thing you only learn through replication. This wasn't written down in any of the history books. So that was interesting. The boiler itself is an unusual design. First of all, the fire grate is quite a long way down, as it were, just at the base of the vertical tube. But it's also there is a horizontal component, and the flue gases had to pass all the way through the horizontal component before the steam was allowed into the cylinder. It was very difficult to maintain. It would have been a nightmare for the maintenance teams on the Liverpool and Manchester to have gone with a model of this design. So much easier on Rocket.
Now we've looked at Rocket and novelty, let's look at Planet, which was the sort of the end stage of early locomotive development, shall we? So here we are at Planet, which really represented an end stage in early locomotive development. Could you explain to us some of the adaptations that Planet's got that the early locomotives wouldn't have had?
Certainly. If we start with George Stephenson's locomotives that he used on the Killingworth line, the Hetton line, and also the Stockton and Darlington, they were very simple cylindrical boilers with a single flue, the cylinders set into the top. They were slow. They worked, but they were slow, and they were cumbersome, I think is the right word. Robert Stephenson was given this task by his father to develop the steam locomotive suitable for fleet operation on the new Liverpool to Manchester line. And in just 33 months after he was given that task at the beginning of 1828, he went through a series of prototypes, including, of course, Rocket, as we've just seen, and then concluded the development programme with Planet. Planet marks the culmination of the development work. Thereafter, the locomotives just got bigger and more powerful, creating more steam and so on. So the essential components of the locomotive, which we came to recognise in any steam locomotive that was built subsequently, is a separate firebox made integrally with the boiler barrel, the boiler with multiple tubes in it, a smoke box, which provides a vacuum chamber, which means that when this exhaust is ejected through the chamber and up the chimney, it creates a draw on the fire, which is such an important part of the front-end design of a steam locomotive. The cylinders are inside the frame, therefore it's much more stable than the outside cylinders of the of Rocket and the other early locos. The frame is now a sandwich frame made of oak or elm, plated on either side by wrought iron, which makes it a very stiff and very robust frame. And so the whole locomotive can generate plenty of steam. It can achieve speeds in excess of 30 miles an hour, although in fleet service, 25 to 30 was usual. And it could make enough steam to get itself from Manchester here all the way through to Liverpool. And so it was a very successful locomotive. Not only did the first fleet of Planets operate the starting services on the Liverpool and Manchester line, but further examples were built for subsequent railways in this country, in Europe and in North America. And so began the great locomotive building industry that this country became so famous for in the 19th century.
So this was effectively like an early standard design that people adapted to for their particular countries and railways.
That's right, yes, yes. Axle loading of the locomotives was not too great to break the rails, so you could guarantee that some of the railways that were first built had lightweight rails and would otherwise break the track. But very quickly, of course, the requirement for more speed and for greater load hauling capability meant that you needed to extend the locomotive, so they put on a third axle at the rear with a longer boiler and a larger firebox, the patentee engines, which then took the railway development forward through the 1830s.
Lovely, thank you, Michael.
Softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Kayla Itsinas.
Kayla Itsinas. I'm Kayla Itsinas, and I have been training a global community of women since 2009. I've created a brand new podcast, Sweat Daily, to help you level up your life and reach your health and well-being goals. From fitness tips to food that fuels you, meditation to motivation, we've got you covered. Sweat Daily, the happiest, healthiest, and most confident version of you awaits. Available on Apple Podcasts and wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.